are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, October 15th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live, not steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal, nor are we in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. But instead, we are in Las Vegas, Nevada, USA, in the grand ballroom of the Bellagio Hotel for the 2015 Mass Torts Conference in Las Vegas. And today on the program, we will talk to a couple of attorneys who, maybe three. I don't know. I rarely know exactly when I start the program here when I am at this conference who we're going to get as a guest at any given time. However, I know we're going to be talking to a couple of attorneys who are working on litigation that either raises the issue actually at hand, you know, the specific litigation, or broader issues about accessibility to the courts and different strategies that corporations have to prevent people from getting to the courts. We're also going to be talking to some media folks. Tom Hartman is here. I don't know if that's going to happen today or tomorrow. David Pakman, others. And first off, let me just say this, and I will get to I'll get to this more because I have my first guest is already seated. Yesterday on the program, I did an ad for FanDuel. We had been doing ads for FanDuel in the past. I know a piece had come out in the Times about a week or two ago that suggested there was a rivalry between two different online rotisserie betting sites, where the employees on one site were attempting to game the other site, et cetera, et cetera. Well, yesterday after the program, I actually met an attorney who is beginning to, or they've started litigation against DraftKings and FanDuel, charging insider betting. It's a class action lawsuit that seems to be going forward with Jones and Ward. Now, I couldn't get anybody to talk to me about this on the program today just because of scheduling issues. But simultaneously, there was a story in the Wall Street Journal, and I imagine one in the Times as well, that FBI agents have been contacting customers of DraftKings. I presume they're going to be contacting all of these rotisserie football sites within, if they haven't already. So, look, we were scheduled to run an ad for them today. I'm not going to do it. I mean, you know, I'm sitting here in Las Vegas. You're old enough to know whether or not you want to engage in gambling, but in an instance where there's some questions as to the transparency and to the legitimacy of what's going on there, and I'm not making any accusations. I'm just basically saying I know of a pending lawsuit and I know of investigations. So I'm going to choose not to do that ad today and hopefully make it up at the craps table to create the irony. But I will say this, and So let that be the way it is. And we'll talk about Harry's.com because there is no such scandal around Harry's.com. Shaving still seems to be the most transparent thing that you can do at this point. But before we get to that, I want to welcome to the program Mike Berg. He is from Berg, Simpson, Eldridge, Hirsch, and Jardine. And we have spoken in the past. Mike, welcome to the program. Oh, let me get you up a little bit more.
How's that?
I don't know why that... one more time. Could you just talk into that microphone?
It's a pleasure being here.
Oh, okay. There we go. I'm getting you. All right. Now, Mike, we've spoke... I guess it was... Gosh, 2 years ago, maybe.
A year and a half or 2 years ago, yeah.
Okay. About litigation that your firm had begun to get involved with in the construction area.
Correct.
Just remind me the issues and the scope of the cases that you're getting involved in.
Well, the scope, first of all, it goes to builders who are not building homes or condominiums or commercial projects in a way that they're not defective. And most of it goes to homeowners. And this really is an important topic for all your listeners. Anyone who owns a home or a condominium, they put a lot of money down. That's probably their biggest purchase they make in their life. And what's going around the country is that there are builders who are building these projects in a substandard way. And so it's an amazing thing that's going on is that we have been suing these builders for not building your home correctly. It may be that they didn't put the soils in correctly and you've got water seeping in. It may be that in a condo project they didn't put the roof on correctly and you have leaks, or you don't have the sleeve of the building, or the windows are not properly installed. And it's a huge problem, because when you have that happen to you and you've paid for your home, and and now you go back to the builder and the builder goes, well, that's not really my problem. And so we've been very successful in having, I mean, for example, this year, in the last 2 years.
Let me stop you right here.
Sure.
And I think longtime listeners of the show know that one of my favorite television programs ever was Homes on Homes, where I don't know if you ever saw that one, but it's a contractor goes around and fixes screw-ups that other contractors have done and just gets incredibly outraged by the work that he sees. And he's always mystified, and to a certain extent, I have the same question. When you come across a building, you were telling me some construction where they don't even put rebar in the cement. Is this a function of, and just so the people know, rebar, these sort of metal sort of dowels, if you will, which make cement structurally sound, because cement wants to move a little bit, and so these basically
Correct.
Hold it together from the inside. And so when you see these things, is it a function of just sheer incompetence, or is it a function of, like, we're going to hire people who are incompetent so that it doesn't cost us that much and we don't have any quality controls? Or they just basically say, like, I don't want to spend the money on dowels.
It's a combination of all three. What we see is, first of all, the unions, unfortunately, and I'm a big union advocate, they really don't exist anymore. So we do no longer have this training for master plumbers or master electricians or masonry. And so we have amateurs doing the work. And there it's strictly negligence and inability to understand how to do the work properly. You don't have these problems in Canada or other places where you can't work on these projects unless you have attained the union certification. So here we have people doing the work who are incompetent. But we also have people that bid a job, and they'll bid the job either as a contractor or a subcontractor, and they'll bid it very low. And in order for them to make money, they have to cut corners. They have to figure out, how can we hide the problems that we're going to do? We had one case in a huge home in which they didn't put the structural protection in, and they covered it up by the drywall.
What do you mean that the structural protection?
Well, for example, when you put a roof on, you have to have it attached either with metal, a structural material that will keep the roof from collapsing. Here, there were supposed to be 12 of those kind of metal attachments. There was one. And ultimately, thank goodness they weren't home at the time, but in the children's bedroom, there was a huge structural defect that collapsed and would have killed or injured or maimed these children had they been in the house during that period of time. That's we see that all the time. And when we went in and our experts went in and said, we need to look and we need to knock down the walls and we need to get through what you've hidden, they said, well, we're never going to pay for that because it's all done right. Well, guess what? We got in there and we found all those things and all the defects. What's going on, though, is the home builders are trying to get legislation passed.
All right, I want to get to this point because what you're talking about, this next part is really sort of is really fascinating to me. But is what they're doing just sort of fraud? In other words, are there statutes on the books? Before we get to the liability issues and access to the courts, are there statutes on the books that say, because I don't know how you write this if you're not like, that there has to be 12 of those attachments? I mean, or are there sort of like standards out there, building standards out there that statute says you must attain these building standards as established by blah, 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 because there doesn't seem to be any regulatory agency
building codes. Every community will have a building code. And there has to be an inspection, and they have to be approved by the code. The problem is that in most municipalities, you have two problems. One is there's not enough inspectors, and so they don't have the ability to really do the inspection that it takes before they sign off. And two, there's a close relationship many times between the inspectors, and I don't want to go beyond that as to whether or not they get paid or whether or not something's under the table, but there's a close relationship in which those inspectors sign off, and we've seen it in every area, whether it's the plumbing, the electrical, whether it's the masonry, whether it's the structural soundness of the buildings, where somebody is signed off on it, but in fact, it doesn't meet the building code standard.
What happens to that guy in the course of, I'm just hypothetically speaking, you have a case where you're dealing with, I don't know, the 12 things on the roof or something that's a little bit less, let's say, life-threatening. And, a guy says to his buddy, you know, the plumber, like, don't worry about it. This is not a safety issue. There may be some leaking down the road, but, you know, everybody's got to change the toilet at one point or another. When you find something like that and it's been signed off, like, what happens to that?
Nothing. Nothing happens to that person. They're a government employee who is has
are they they're shielded from
they are.
Liability.
They're immune. They didn't build it. They signed off on it. But the builders want to use that as a defense.
Right.
That we met the building code, even though when we bring our experts in, they say, of course you didn't. You know, this was supposed to have copper piping, and you put in a less appropriate metal for the piping.
That's got
to
happen a lot because copper is now so expensive.
Absolutely.
To people.
And the electrical is not done up to code. And then there's fire codes that we have to worry about. So all those things, those people have no liability for this. And it's the sad part is that without being able to go to court, the homeowners, the audience out there, your home, you have no recourse against that builder to make sure that what you paid for is what you got.
Right. Because it's not like a simple fraud case, I guess, where it's like, I'm going to deliver you 12 donkeys on Friday and give me your money and I just walk away with it, right? Or something to that effect.
Right.
And you deliver, I'm going to deliver you 12 horses and you end up delivering donkeys, I guess. And say, no, these are horses. They just have long ears.
They
look
funny, right.
So, all right. So get to this point about what the builders are now doing in terms of the municipal, this fight about access to the courts. And this is what people really have to understand is that this happens in every nook and cranny of our system where consumers are, there's an attempt by corporations, whether it's like individual corporations on the level you're about to talk about, or broadly speaking, we saw this with AT&T a couple of years ago. They want to prevent individuals and class action suits from getting to the courts. This issue of access to the courts is so huge.
Well, what's going on is that we've been very successful, and we've been successful because we brought in the top experts, and we've gone to jurors, and we've proven to them that these builders have to, and their insurance companies have to come in and fix this so that you have a habitable home that you can live in. And as a response to that, they've gone to legislators and legislatures around the country, Arizona, Nevada, Colorado. There's a movement in almost every state to have the state legislators basically prohibit in one form or another your ability to have a jury trial, to get to a jury. Most of these, in Colorado, for example, we beat it back in the last legislation.
So what is the form that these statutes take in the states?
They take all different forms, but I want to say there's another level, because when they lose in the legislature, what they then go is to this, what I'll describe as a fraud on the public through the municipalities. Right now it's called affordable housing. If you hear the word, we don't have enough affordable housing. That's the actual key word for, we want to make sure the builders are not held responsible, and therefore we need to stop lawsuits. And by the way, there's no correlation between lack of affordable housing and poor workmanship in building homes.
So wait a second. So they say we need a statute in this city,
an ordinance
in this city, to allow for affordable housing, and the only way we can get affordable housing is if we don't have liability for poor workmanship.
Correct. And they claim that we can't get insurance and all kinds of things. And what they do is they're all done in different ways. For example, one that we saw recently.
Who's pushing this? Are there trade groups? Are there lobbying?
The Builders Association, the real estate, the realtors, the Home Builders Association, very powerful, powerful people nationally. You know, the
and
people,
are these national organizations going in and doing the municipal things?
Yes.
And so they're targeting big cities, I would imagine.
Everywhere.
Wow.
Everywhere. And on these ordinances they're trying to pass. And we think it's unconstitutional, the ordinance, because it's a statewide issue. And so let's start with whether you have a right to a jury trial. But some of them say if the person at the city who signs off that it met the code, you can't bring an action. Some of them, and most all of them, say if you find a defect, you have to give them notice, and then you allow that same builder that may have committed fraud has to be allowed to come in to, quote, fix it. Well, what homeowner who now has found that there's all these problems with their home or their condo or their homeowner association wants that same builder? And again, not every builder is a bad builder, and what drives us crazy is you would think that the good home builders would want the ones that are cheating and lying and doing substandard work to be held accountable. But there's some.
But they've got to be worried too.
Of course.
Because their fellow companies and construction and associations are saying, like, look, your livelihood is on the line here. This is going to increase your liability. When in fact, so let's just be. I want to be clear here. So they're coming in and they're pushing these ordinances that range from if you find a defect, it goes to forced arbitration.
Right. No. Yeah. Right. Absolutely no jury trials.
No
forced
jury
arbitration.
Or if you find a defect, there's no liability if it has been signed off by a code inspector.
Correct.
From the city. And you know, anybody associated with any type of building knows that, like, well, I spoke to the code guy. He's going to be here at 3, but I closed it up already this morning, you know, and I had to put the drywall in there. So I'm just going to show him here's the breaker box and here's this. And, you know, that should be enough for him. And there's no way, you know, the code inspector's not going to say, like, tear it all down. Let me take a look at it again. So there's probably a lot of that goes on.
And there's some really good code inspectors, but there's some that just are going through the motions. They have too many projects they have to look at in a short period of time.
And so is there any, I mean, you know, so much of the problems with this are that there's no organized entity that pushes back, right? So tell us the implications. First, tell us the implications of what forced arbitration does.
Well, first of all, there are many, many organizations that choose, depending on what they put in that ordinance, that basically have people from the building industry become your arbitrators. That's the same thing that happens in the securities industry when you go to FINRA. those arbitrators that you must go to are basically in bed with the banks and the securities brokers. The same thing happens here, where many of the arbitrators are in bed with the home builders. And what we've done is we've organized protests at all the municipalities where they're doing this. But unfortunately, money talks in politics. Whether
right.
it's
and you guys aren't even
level.
In that business. Right. I mean, in fact, we're going to be talking, actually, to Douglas Land from the Action Network, which does these type
Correct.
Of things. And it really is an example of why an organization like that is so important, because there's really no pushback.
We've
here,
worked
is
with
there?
Them and with other organizations like them. But what's what really is frustrating is that there might be 100 people saying, don't do this to us, don't do this to us. But the people on the city council, the mayor, they are getting so much money for their elections, even in the local level, from these organizations.
And a dollar. Look, I mean, the reality is a dollar in a city of 200,000 people for that politician is, you know, is like, I don't know, 100
right.
for a congressman
well,
and 10,000 for...
City council races used to be very, very inexpensive to run.
Right.
Now they're dumping a lot of money in it because they want to get these people to put these ordinances in and to create the inability. And we bring in homeowners who we have pictures of people who can't get into their house because the doors are collapsed or because it slid off the road or because it leaked and damaged everything inside a huge condo project. And we bring those people, bring them to the city council. But the city council says, yes, but we need development. We need affordable housing. We need the builders to come in here and do this. And it's those darn lawyers. They don't use the word darn. I use that. Lawyers who are causing all the problems when, in fact, we're just there to try to protect your listeners and every homeowner's rights. We're not going to bring a case where there's nothing wrong with your home.
Because you're going to end up spending a lot of money. I mean, that's basically the game. And I've come to realize that here, too, is that you need to have a firm when you're talking about some of these bigger cases in particular and broader cases. You need to have a firm that's really well capitalized, because that's sort of what you're fighting, right? It's like they know to a certain extent a law firm that works with no pay up front
right.
can't stay in the game for very long, so they can string them out.
I think it's important also to know that, like on these big condo projects, we have to go into every condo and look at it. And in those cases, our costs, just for the experts, run $1 million or more. And so how do you protect 50 units or 100 units that are really in bad shape if you don't have the financial wherewithal? Because we advance that money for those costs on behalf of our
right.
clients, not to mention the fact we don't get paid unless we succeed. And guess what? We're succeeding. And that's why they're going after us, both at the state and the municipal level, because there's so much bad construction in this country.
Well, I got to say, Michael Berg, it's impossible for me to imagine that there's this type of level of corruption on a local or state level that corporations could have such power, because I've been told time and time again by libertarians that the real reason why we have corruption in government is because the federal government exists, and local control would bring far more transparency. But Michael Berg, thank you so much for your time today. Fascinating story. And again, just another example of that dynamic, which happens sort of both, on a local level, but also on a national level. Keep people out of the courts, because once we can dismantle the regulatory structure of government on some level, the only thing between essentially the corporations being able to do whatever they want and not is our attorneys. Yeah,
let me just give one final thought, which is people, every out there listeners, speak up. You know, Bernie Sanders, I don't know what Democratic candidate or if anybody wants, but he says we need a revolution. We need a revolution where the public, in this particular instance, as well as others, stand up and say, go to city council and say, we're going to vote you out. You're not protecting us. Do everything you can to help us to protect you. And again, I appreciate the ability to come on, and it's really great to see you again.
Great to see you too, Michael.
Thank you
very much. All right, folks. So here's the plan. I'm going to, in just a minute, Douglas Land is going to join us. He's sitting right over there with the beard. And we're going to take a quick break in a minute. But let me just tell you this. I'm very excited to tell you that Harry's.com, still remaining a sponsor. We probably lost a sponsor today. Thank you. We probably lost a sponsor today, but what are you going to do? I mean, I'm not going to promote a service that is currently under investigation by the FBI, and I'm now aware of potential litigation. However, I will say this, that that Harry's, on the other hand, Harry's is not under investigation. In fact, it is an incredibly transparent process, far more transparent than those huge plastic containers that you buy your razors in. You know I don't like to shave, but I did actually shave today, and our next guest will attest to the fact, you can't see me, but will attest that I am clean shaven, and it's because, and I don't know, there is something about shaving with like a nice handle and blades that are sharp, and I also know that don't cost me an arm and a leg, that I'm not saying I'm going to shave that often, but Harry's is about half the price of other big branded blades. They ship it free to your front doorstep. I mean, $30 some odd bucks for an 8-pack of blades. It's half the price at Harry's. With Harry's, you'll get a better shave that respects your skin, your face, your legs. I imagine really any part of your body that you want to shave, and your wallet. No more poor quality blades and no pesky plexiglass cabinets to unlock either. The starter set is an amazing deal. For $15, you get a razor, moisturizing shave cream, and three razor blades. And with the promo code MajorityReport, you can get $5 off that amazing deal. So that's $10 for those of you who cannot add. If you have never gotten Harry's before, $10 for a razor, shaving cream, and three blades. With the coupon code, or I should say the promo code MajorityReport. So go to harrys.com now. Harry will give you $5 off if you type in that coupon code MajorityReport, as long as it's your first purchase. If not, you're still getting a great deal of $15. That's harrys.com. Enter the coupon code MajorityReport at checkout and for $5 off. Start shaving better today. Okay, joining me now is the chairman of the board of Action Network, and Douglas Lant, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here. And yes, indeed, you are nicely clean shaven this morning.
Thank you very much for establishing that. Full transparency here. Now, you know, I was just having a conversation with Mike Berg, an attorney who works on construction issues. And he was saying that one of the things that they're starting to see now is construction associations, lobbying groups are on a municipal and state level going in and trying to get statutes that basically deflect them from liability for poor craftsmanship, for cutting corners, for a whole host of things that these contractors will do to save money. And, you know, a couple of dollars on a municipal level that can really change things. And one of the problems that I've seen on this throughout, whether it's like security stuff or really anything, there is no sort of equivalent on the playing field to these trade associations for consumers. You know, even for workers to a certain extent, I mean, we have unions, although that's diminishing significantly, but there's really no sort of like real pushback. And you, that's where you guys come in.
That's exactly where we come in. The Action Network was formed to really try to create a way of leveling the playing field, particularly against corporate abuse or other forms of abusive practices of organizations, but particularly corporate abuse. And there's a lot of rhetoric around that. I mean, everybody wants to talk about the balance, you know, restoring balance in the economy, but or restoring balance between people and corporations. We've really taken a somewhat different and we think a new and pretty innovative approach, taking advantage of all of the new tools that are available via technology, social media, interactivity, as well as really focusing on what we believe is a networked approach. There are a lot of organizations out there that want to do good. You mentioned trade unions. There are others, but they typically haven't really worked together that well.
Right. And so, and now, I mean, you say you're taking advantage of technology, social media, and then sort of how much easier it is to network and email lists. And but what, like, specifically, to what end? I mean, give us a sense of one of the campaigns you're working on now.
Okay, I'll give you, well, there's a couple that I think would really bring this into focus.
Great.
You know, specific to a current project we're working on in the Mid-Ohio Valley, there are a number, you know, hundreds of thousands of citizens that were impacted by C8, which is a chemical that DuPont had put into the water systems in that Mid-Ohio Valley.
And I should just say at this point that tomorrow I'm going to be talking to an attorney from Levin Papantonio. Mike Papantonio, my co-host on Ring of Fire, has just won the first, as far as I know, the first case, and it's going to be it's huge. And I should also just remind people that a couple of months ago we spoke to, I think it was Sharon Lerner from The Intercept, who had written a 3-part series on DuPont and C8, and this is a devastating sort of byproduct of this chemical. But continue.
Right, and again, you have impacted communities up and down the Mid-Ohio Valley with, again, a particular focus around Parkersburg, West Virginia, where the plant that DuPont had was putting this chemical into the water. But again, thinking about what the Action Network has done, there was a community there, but they really had not been able to organize and create an effective campaign to actually force DuPont to take responsibility for their actions. So what we've done is we've worked with a very, very solid group of local community folks, but helped them create a campaign called Keep Your Promises, DuPont. Again, trying to force DuPont to provide the appropriate compensation for these injured folks. So how did we do that? Through a combination of things. First of all, just help them organize. Our roots come from an organizing route. We also implemented and helped them use technology to reach out to a number of other members of their community so that they could actually work together. But also, and this is again where the networking approach comes in, to really build an effective campaign, we found that there were a number of other organizations that also were looking at C8, that had published on C8. You had the Environmental Working Group, who's done a wonderful job on a scientific level, looking at the great harm that C8 has caused, but they were kind of disassociated with the folks in the Mid-Ohio Valley who were actually impacted by this. So we helped, again, build the network, bringing together these organizations in a much more powerful voice. And the Action Network also has its own technology tools, which we offer to these organizations, again, to help them work together. And finally, we also identified the real stakeholders who have a real stake in the outcome of this, so that the folks, when DuPont was spinning off its specialty chemical division, we made sure that the analysts who were covering the spinoff and looking at Chemours as a separate corporation understood the huge exposure that they had associated with this.
Okay, that last part is really interesting to me, because you know, one of the things that I think we've spoken to Chris Hayes about this, and he's talked about this, is that one of the fights against climate change is to one of the sort of the key leverage point or inflection point for climate change in terms of fighting it is to convince capital that it's going to be too expensive and they're going to get fewer returns down the road if they invest in carbon-based energy today. So in other words, like, hey, they're going to come to you and they're going to want you to invest whatever it is, $100 million in an oil rig. It's a mistake, because by the time that oil rig starts pumping the oil out of the sea, gas will be at, you know, whatever it is, $32 a barrel, and you won't make your money back. Or there's going to be such taxation on carbon that you're not going to make any profits. And so at some level, when you go to an analyst, when they're spinning off this thing, you're basically saying to DuPont, like, look, you're not going to get what you think you're going to get out of this unless you deal with this issue that you don't want to deal with.
Exactly. There's really two levels. One is, as you said, forcing them to account for their liabilities today. You know, I think most corporations try, and you read their reports, they identify, oh, we have this liability, we just don't know what it is, so we're going to kind of put off to the future what you can't quantify today. We really are trying to force them to change the way they think about that, to say these are real liabilities. And I think the verdict that Mike Papantonio just got begins to show that these are real liabilities, liabilities that they need to deal with now.
Didn't the DuPont CEO just resign? Was this right?
Like the day before, the day after the verdict. Yes, she resigned. Again, we can all speculate. I'm not sure there's a direct relationship, but clearly, DuPont has been in a very unsettled position for a long time. And I think that actually the C8 issue is a perfect example of really what's going on in DuPont with regard to uncertainties regarding a huge number of liabilities that they're facing, whether it's liabilities for cleaning up of these old landfills that they have over the country. I think their annual report identifies over 100 hazardous waste sites that are going to need remediation. They've done some estimates of what those remediation costs are, but I don't think they've really made an effort to specifically deal with them. And again, so what we're trying to do is force the conversation.
So, I mean, metaphorically, when you talk about this stuff, it's like you guys are standing up in the middle of the shareholders meeting, and the board has just tried to sort of brush by something, and you're standing up and going, wait, one second. Everybody here should hear this.
Absolutely. And again, even to the point of like in the Chemours situation, Chemours is the spinoff of the specialty chemical division that DuPont just completed, from starting with basically trying to, I say, ignore or gloss over these liabilities. In their most recent quarterly presentation to investors, they have an entire section of their presentation which now deals with the litigation exposure from C8, which is exactly what the Keep Your Promises group wants them to do. They want them to take responsibility for their actions. And again, and this is where the Action Network helped this group of citizens in the Mid-Ohio Valley create a voice that as individuals they didn't have, but by creating an organization, by helping them, we raised their voice.
What is the, I mean, I imagine you think about this stuff, you know, both strategically and tactically, but what is sort of the, your notion of how this impacts future behavior? Because we're talking about DuPont is having to, they're being held accountable, rightly so, for decisions that maybe were made 30 years ago.
Absolutely.
In some instances, maybe more. And to a certain extent, you know, and particularly in this day and age, it seems to me you have board of directors and CEOs whose sense of accountability, not just to the broader public, but even their own company, the horizon's a lot shorter, it seems to me, right? It's just basically shortly after their stocks have vested.
Yep.
And they get to cash out and they get their big compensation. You know, Carly Fiorina comes to mind to a certain extent, who got paid millions,
63, I think,
for destroying her company. How do you impact that future behavior of an increasingly myopic, I guess, class of board of directors and CEOs?
I see, and again, that's where when I started the discussion about new technology, I really believe that by integrating everything we now can use in terms of social media broadly, and I use that term, you know, quite broadly, it actually does change their behavior because they know that the reaction can be immediate,
right,
and can be incredibly powerful. And most importantly, it now starts to actually impact their brand, and it can impact their brand tomorrow. Not, you know, it used to be a litigation could go on
right
for 15 years, and you know what? If the litigation went on for 15 years, yeah, they paid the lawyers, you know, their defense lawyers $10 million a month. It was just a rounding error in their financial statements. But all of a sudden, when their behavior, whether it's VW with the diesel
right.
situation is the perfect example. You come back to Bank America when they tried to put that $5. It was an immediate reaction because of the power of the...
Well, it could literally be someone who has 50,000 followers and tweets it out, and there's a video that goes viral, and all of a sudden they're in a different realm where their brand is in danger, right?
Absolutely. And again, I think that this is where, again, just so it's clear, we are not, and the Action Network is not anti-corporate in any way. We are, but we are looking at specific corporate abuses. We did a big project and helped some of the victims from the pelvic mesh disaster that Johnson & Johnson created. Johnson & Johnson is a really good company. They probably have 100,000 employees, of which 99,000 plus are great, dedicated employees. This particular product and a few other Johnson & Johnson products.
We've actually, I think, spoken to attorneys on the vaginal mesh
right.
story. I mean, just horrific. Right.
That was a horrible product, and I think that the real opportunity that citizens now have, that consumers now have, is instead of just fighting it out one case at a time in a courtroom that, again, Johnson & Johnson is more than happy to try 100 cases and keep paying their lawyers, all of a sudden, when the real, and again, that is a situation, there were victims of the pelvic mesh product, injured victims who stood up at the shareholders meeting, got a lot of press coverage. They had to deal with it.
Right.
All of a sudden, it's not just about the $10 or $20 or $100 million they may have to pay out. It's about their brand. It's
right.
about how people think about their brand, which is really something that wasn't available to
right.
consumers before the technology that exists today.
So before it was just like, okay, we pay out $50 million on this. That's an operating cost.
Absolutely.
It's just like it's just another line item on our budget. And sometimes we can, but it all averages out over the course of all our products so that we can sort of amortize that operating cost liability. But now when it's a brand, that's something you cannot.
They can't afford to. And unfortunately, I would actually say that the economic kind of discussion that you just had, if it's only $50 or $100 million, we amortize it. I think we've actually seen, and we know from some of the documents, that they actually make that calculation directly and in a really ugly way.
Yeah, but we've known this for a long time, right? I mean, this is like this is the Ford Pinto, right?
This is the Ford Pinto, and again, Johnson & Johnson, there was another drug whose name that they just paid out literally billions of dollars in settlements. But when you look at the P&L, they made $10 billion on it. So
right.
the $2 billion they paid in settlement, it was still a good deal.
Right.
And their internal documents basically said, it may cost us a lot, but you know what? We're going to make so much that it's worth it, and that's the calculus we have to change.
Not to pick on Carly Fiorina, but not to not pick on Carly Fiorina. I mean, in reading a lot of stories and talking to people who were from out in like Silicon Valley, I really got a sense that there was actually a very distinct HP culture. Like a corporate culture. And, I've not worked really in too many corporate settings. But from your perspective, and that she came in and either was sort of brought in to destroy it or just was the person to destroy that culture, do you have a sense of, like, is there a list in your office of, like, these are the companies whose the culture there that sort of repeatedly have this sense of if we can get away with it and it's only going to cost us this, we will do that. Are there specific ones or is that sort of like endemic to a bigger system like that?
We don't have a list. So I wish we could have that. That list might be helpful. I do think that the way that litigation has gone has actually in the past 10 to 15 years has been tilted so in favor of the corporations that they have been very effective at changing the playing field to allow that culture. They've just looked at, as you said before, litigation and paying out for wrongdoing is just a cost of doing business.
Right.
So there really isn't a There wasn't any way of, again, changing the calculus. Again, it just became a cost of doing business. And I don't, again, we don't think of it as a target list, but we do look at individual kind of individual elements or individual activities.
Have there been times where something's come across your desk where you're like, oh, I'm really surprised to hear that? In other words, like, oh, DuPont had developed a chemical that they knowingly, it was making their employees crazy. I would imagine you see a story of that, like, I don't know, some other chemical, you'd be like, well, that's DuPont. I mean, because they've done this, they've seemed to have done this for 70, 80 years. Are there companies where you look at this and go, I'm really surprised to see that?
Unfortunately, no. I think at this point, again, because it's, at least in our experience, it's kind of individual abuses, or it's an individual product manager who may have run
right.
a particular product. Again, we don't typically look at it as systemic to a company, but we do look at it as systemic to the way and how limited the ability for an individually injured person to get appropriate recompense.
Right.
You know, how the system has been so stacked against them, how the legal system has made it so expensive to try to get
is there an alternative system? I mean, is there a model out there where, or did we have a fairly efficient model at one point, and has it been, obviously it has been corrupted on some level, not corrupted, or I should say, you know, sort of like literally like denigrated, because we see less and less access to the courts by people. But is there a model out there? I don't know. Sweden? Denmark? Or is there...
Denmark, isn't that where Bernie Sanders thinks we should be looking to?
I got no problems with that, frankly. But
this is the United States. Now, again, I think that what we need to do is look at each individual kind of element of some of the things like the tort reform that people are clamoring for. It's being vigilant to make sure that those things don't, again, limit access to the court, make it so expensive for claimants to bring cases to the court. Again, the one thing, and I have been involved in some international litigation, you know, I do think that, and again, we see some of that here, but, in the British system, when you bring a case like some of the ones we're talking about, you also have the winner gets paid their legal fees as well as whatever damages, you know,
uh-huh.
So loser pays. So again, I think in many instances that forces people to come to the table sooner because they're not going to want to end up with, in addition to whatever penalty or damages,
uh-huh.
Again, look at the C8 case. Okay, there's a $1.6 million verdict. If they had also had to pay legal fees, there were probably millions of dollars of legal fees have been put into that case. I think that that does have a lot of benefits, and you do see that it kind of forces companies, it forces both parties to, I think, make a much more realistic kind of view, take a more realistic view of what they kind of what their exposure is, and potentially increases the exposure. Again, I think that when you saw with tobacco was an incredibly strong kind of. It showed that the system can work.
Right.
And I think it took a long time, and it took an incredible investment by a huge number of people and attorneys general across the country to come together. But when they did, I think that was an incredible kind of way of saying the system can work. It's just so expensive. I mean, think about how much had to be invested by the lawyers, by the attorneys general to get to that point. We need to find a way to make it so it's not so expensive, such a high hurdle in order to force companies to come to the table.
Douglas Land, where can people get more information on the Action Network?
CorporateActionNetwork.org is our website. You can look at Keep Your Promises. You can look at some of the work we've done for the Walmart wage equality campaign. One of the other things we've done is Making Change at Walmart. We helped them organize Black Friday protests in 1,400 cities across the country. But again, Keep Your Promises, which again has its website, keepyourpromises.org, as well as, again, corporateactionnetwork.org.
Thank you so much for your time today.
My
really appreciate it. All right, folks, going to take a quick break. I don't know. Do you guys just deserve the song Myla's version of Move Like Jagger right now? Maybe we'll We'll hold off on that until a little bit later. We'll be right back. We're going to talk about Invanica. Invacana. It's a drug that apparently is not terribly effective. We'll be right back after this. Ugh. Gentlemen, we are back. Sam Cedar. I continue my coverage of, it's not really coverage. I'm not covering the conference so much as I am using this as an opportunity to talk to attorneys who work in the field of mass torts. And you know what? Maybe it's a good time for us to define the word torts. And I have Travis Lepesier. He is he's an attorney with Levin Papantonio, Mike Papantonio's firm, and also Levin, of course, one of the partners, was massive in the architecture of the tobacco settlement back in the day. And every year I keep saying I've got to sit down with him and try and sort of hear how that developed. But Travis, welcome to the program. Tell us, what is a tort for those people who either didn't go to law school or who quit after a year like myself?
Sure, absolutely. Thank you for having me, Sam. A tort is simply a civil wrong. Typically, folks think of the law and they think of a civil case or a criminal case. The civil cases are the tort cases. So when someone, a private citizen or a corporation, has wronged another person, then that is a tort, and you would bring a civil action in that instance.
And mass torts are basically when this harm has been done to a lot of people, and those people come together as a class and pursue an action against another party who has harmed that class. And it's usually done because the harms themselves are either small enough or the cost of fighting this case is large enough that they can't do it on their own. And so, okay, so what division do you work in at Levin Papantonio?
I work in the mass torts department. I work on a lot of pharmaceutical cases. Products cases are typically where you're going to see mass torts because you've got corporations that have sold a massive amount of their medical devices or their pharmaceutical devices, and it turns out these devices or pharmaceutical drugs are harming people in some way, and it typically ends up being a significant number. And as you said, it's much more efficient to go through the MDL process because these folks have similar issues. Multi-district litigation, that's what we call the litigation when everything is centralized. When you have cases all across the country, attorneys will be filing them, likely in federal court, some in state court. But when there's enough cases filed, one of the attorneys will eventually move to have the case transferred to a multi-district litigation, an MDL. And that promotes a more efficient outcome for the plaintiffs and quite frankly, for the defendants as well.
Okay, so in other words, we've got cases on this drug X, and there are people suffering from that drug in California. There are people suffering from that drug in Vermont. There's people suffering from that drug in Florida and in states across the country. That's what we mean by multi-district.
Correct. Absolutely.
And so we'll all combine this. That way, The defense lawyers and the plaintiff lawyers don't have to go to each state and travel around the country. All right, so you're working on, what is it, Invocana. Okay, so tell us what Invocana is, who makes it, and how it is that you guys like pick up a case like this.
Sure. Invocana is a diabetes medication. It's indicated for treatment of type 2 diabetics. It's in a new class of drugs that just recently came on the market. In fact, Invocana was the first drug in this class on the market in the U.S. in the spring of 2013. What the drug class is called is an SGLT2 inhibitor. Now, the importance of that is the drug prevents your body from metabolizing sugar, and instead it flushes all of this unmetabolized sugar through your kidneys. This has detrimental effects. There's a number of injuries that are associated with this drug. For instance, there's kidney failure. There's an issue that many diabetics are familiar with in diabetic ketoacidosis. And there's also very early indications in cardiovascular event studies that heart attacks and strokes are going to be a significant problem with Invocana.
Okay, so this is what you call a design versus a failure, warning, right? Is it case?
I mean, well, actually, Sam, that's the interesting part of this case. This drug was designed so poorly that there's actually a design defect theory behind the case as well as a failure to warn, because the Invocana label and the other drugs in this class do not warn of cardiovascular events, they do not warn of kidney failure, and they do not warn of diabetic ketoacidosis. But when you look at the mechanism of how the drug is actually working, that they purposefully enacted an emergency mechanism, and just to back up and explain that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, you gotta...
When you have diabetic ketoacidosis, your body is trying to expel the acid. So, and back up a little bit further, diabetic ketoacidosis means that you have excess acid in your blood. It means your pH is off balance and there's too much acid. So your body is trying to cope with that extra acid, and there's a number of mechanisms that it has. You'll increase your breathing and you'll urinate more to get the excess acid out of your body. What they've done with this drug is made the sugar bypass your kidney absorption function, which is going to allow the sugar to be used as energy, and instead it forces that unmetabolized sugar through your kidney. And that's what happens in an emergency situation when you have diabetic ketoacidosis without taking this drug. So that's how your body copes with it. So their solution to high blood sugar, which is what the drug is supposed to treat, is to force this emergency mechanism on you every single day.
Constant, I see. Okay, so let me ask you this, and I want to find out how it is, like, I mean, how you find out about a case about this or how you find out a drug, but give me a sense of, like, what your, and you may not be able to answer this question other than beyond, like, a theory. Like, how does a drug company develop a drug like this? Like, why would they do it? Or is it, I mean, there aren't scientists sitting around saying, okay, we need to develop a drug that will put diabetics in the constant state of, like, sort of crisis that their body physiologically gets into. And that'll be good. That'll be a good thing. Or is it that they develop a drug and they say, it's going to attempt to do this, but it will also be mitigated by that. And then as they get to the end of that process of developing the drug, they've invested millions of dollars. They've invested years of work. They've put it out in their glossy brochures for their shareholders, like, next year's the years where, you know, Invocana comes out and everything's going to be saved. Is that what happens? Like, how do they put out a drug like this that not only do they fail to warn people about side effects, right, where they could argue, like, oh, we just didn't know, or the studies didn't show that, or it was unclear, but that is, like, fundamentally designed in such a way as to not be good. Right? I mean, how does that happen?
I think it goes to the fundamental thought that these corporations are putting their profits before people. There's a lot of diabetic medications that were on the market beforehand that do what they're intended to do and help the person deal with high blood sugar. What they don't do is short-circuit the body's natural mechanisms and force an excess amount of sugar to be flushed through someone's kidneys. So when you look at how much these drugs are being promoted, especially when you look at Invocana, they're off-label promoting this drug for weight loss, off-label promoting the drug for possibly...
Explain to people what off-label promotion means.
Sure. when a drug is approved by the FDA, the FDA will have a statement that provides what the drug is indicated for. That's what the drug has been approved to treat. If you don't have that indication in your drug label, then you can't market, or you're not supposed to market those benefits to the community. What they're doing with Invokana, and to back up, you asked me who's making Invokana. It's Johnson & Johnson and Janssen Pharmaceuticals who have made Invokana and are marketing Invokana. And they are pushing very heavily to get this drug sold. And they're doing a very good job. And they point to these off-label benefits in a kind of slimy manner. They really will show you that your weight will go down because that's a benefit for diabetics. And keep in mind, diabetics have a weight problem as it is. It's kind of inherent with the condition of diabetes. So they will say that it will reduce your weight, but the reason it's reducing your weight is because you're not using the sugar that you're consuming. You're just having it flushed out your system. But those are valuable calories. And they've got this information in their promotional materials, and it's everywhere in their
promotional materials. Is it in their promotional? Because, you know, like I once took a train sitting next to a guy who was sort of the in-house guy who's supposed to make sure that people are not doing that, who are not, because, you know, when you say they, obviously it's like there's a corporate structure and then there are sales reps and they go out and they're the ones who are talking to the doctors, and the doctor's there and he says, yeah, oh, you should try Invokana for your diabetic patients because what it does is it blah, 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 blah. Incidentally, I should also tell you, I mean, not for nothing, but this stuff makes you lose weight and it's perfectly safe, or it's like, yeah, there's a couple of side effects, but like there isn't there always, we've seen. And that's the way that they sell the off-label, and it one guy does it, but frankly, like, they all do it because they've got to hit their sales quotas, but they're supposed to be a in-house regulator, you know, from the company, not a real regulator, but an in-house quality control saying, like, don't do that. Now, and you're saying that even when they put out the promotional material, like, how is that? Like, it's a diabetes drug, but be careful. You may find yourself looking really thin, and, you know, and is that how? I mean,
no, I mean, they've actually got a document that says it helps reduce weight. I mean, it's plain as day. It's got, you know, their company name on it. It's definitely a document they're using to promote the drug. But I think you make a very good point as well about the sales reps. The sales reps, that's another way that they kind of underhandedly off-label market, because it's not always going to be written down what these sales reps have said to the doctors, and a lot of times they're whispering in their ear, hey, we've also seen that folks are losing a lot of weight on this drug too. You might want to tell your diabetes patients who have weight problems about that effect. And that's definitely off-label promotion.
And the way that works is that there's an absence of accountability within the company structure for sales reps who does that. So in other words, Joe Schmo, everybody in the Midwest region knows Joe Schmo. He'll sell anything off label. But of course, he's also the one who's getting like he won the trip to Bahamas because he had the most sales, as opposed to, yeah, they fired Joe Schmo because he was doing that.
Right, absolutely. I mean,
You guys going through discovery, like do you present that evidence as that they've been selling it off label, or?
Absolutely. That's huge for the case, because when they're marketing off-label, that means that they haven't had approval for that indication, and that's a great theory to move forward when you're prosecuting these cases.
So how do you hear about a case like Invokana? I mean, you're sitting in your office, and what happens, like...
This specific drug, in May of this year, the FDA actually came out with an advisory communication warning the community and warning doctors that diabetic ketoacidosis is a problem with the class of drugs as a whole, SGLT2 inhibitors. So that warning came out in May of this year, and at that time we took a close look at what's going on, and we started to dive into the mechanism of this drug. We talked to doctors about the mechanism of this drug, and the folks that we talked to were just appalled that a company would actually purposefully design a drug to do what this drug does.
Wow. And so what's the next step? You guys Are you advertising? I mean, how did, just walk us through this process. So you guys are getting your, I mean, part of your job is to be around the office and see what the FDA advisory warnings are. I imagine there's other ways in which you guys get cases too. You read a medical journal saying, like, there's been a high incidence of blankety-blank when people take this drug. But in this instance, you see the FDA warning. You go out. You start to investigate it. Is there something actionable here? Is this how widespread is this problem? Like, how do you determine how widespread this problem is? Is it just a function of what their sales are, or is it that you guys, I mean, you know, that's the interesting thing about this conference is, like, part of that is built up there to sort of like locate potential clients. How does that work?
Sure, absolutely. We definitely advertise and let people know that we're looking into this drug. We continue to vet the science that's coming out as well, because we really need to understand the injuries that the drug is causing and whether or not there's a strong argument to make that the drug is actually the cause of these folks' injury.
So at that point, okay, so you've done your investigation and now Travis is just convinced there's something wrong here. This is actionable, and there's potentially X number of plaintiffs out there. So you write that up in a brief. You hand it up to senior partner or whatever the guy is, and says, like, you say, you know, let me go pursue this case, essentially. And they basically say, okay, we have an algorithm, and that algorithm says that if you have X and Y, and this is egregious, and that's egregious, and there's not many patients. And then we're willing, because the decision they're making is to spend a lot of money that may just get wasted, right? Unless there's really a case here.
That's correct, and that's why our vetting process is so thorough. We're not going to jump into a case unless there's really something there to hang our hat on, because if we sink a bunch of resources into a project that doesn't turn around for us, then obviously that's going to be a problem for the firm, and we're not going to be able to jump into other projects and help folks that have been injured by, you know, whatever drug is next in line.
Okay, so you're at this process where you investigated it, you can see there's a case, so now what do you do? You advertise and look for plaintiffs, and part of this is also, this conference is to sort of set up a network of other attorneys across the country who are also looking for plaintiffs.
That's correct, and that's what we're doing now. We're strategizing on where to file cases, where the best venue to file cases is, and we're identifying the other attorneys that are going to be filing cases as well and that are going to be involved in this project. You got to keep in mind, Johnson & Johnson and Janssen are two huge corporations. They have a lot of resources, so they're going to fight the litigation that is going to result from this drug. And you have to have a significant amount of plaintiffs' attorneys across the country that are involved in litigating against companies like this, because they have this massive amount of resources. I mean, keep in mind, Invokana has only been on the market since spring of 2013, but it's already projected to have annual sales at the end of this year of $1.2 billion.
Oh, my. That's a lot on one drug. So that gives you a clue as to why this happens, right? I mean, this is in the pipeline. It's sort of like the movies, right? I mean, we've seen this dynamic play out in movies all the time, it seems like. This device is dangerous. Well, we've invested, our entire company rests on this, and so we're going to put it out there. I mean, that sounds a little melodramatic, but that's basically the dynamic that happens.
I agree with that. I think they've got so much skin in the game. They've invested in this drug, and they want to make sure they get it out there and sold to the public. And when you look at the numbers, you know, that's one thing that's certain, is they're selling this drug in large quantities.
Wow. So how do people, I mean, if there's somebody listening to the program, like, I've been taking Invokana, what's your advice to them?
Okay, if you're taking Invokana, I would definitely talk to your doctor first about, you know, any side effects you may have experienced. You know, any decision about what drugs you're taking to treat whatever ailments you have should definitely be discussed with your doctor. If you have been to the hospital and you've experienced a bout of diabetic ketoacidosis or kidney failure, or you've had a stroke or a heart attack while you were taking Invokana, then I would reach out to an attorney and talk about your legal rights, because it's very likely that you're going to have a cause of action against Johnson & Johnson and Janssen for the injuries that you suffered.
All right. Well, Travis Lepicier.
Lepicier.
Lepicier. So close,
so close.
Travis. Thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate your coming by. And allowing me to understand this process more, because it is fascinating, and it never ceases to amaze me. Sort of, you know, I guess it's just a function of the. I mean, were you surprised when you got into this business? Like, you were like, did your perspective on the way that corporations work change?
Yes. I would say that I was a little naive when I started practicing, kind of believing that everyone was on their best behavior and wouldn't do anything purposefully to harm another person. But when you get into discovery and you get into documents of these litigations and you realize what these folks know and that they didn't tell the public and that they took steps to hide it from the public, in fact, you really realize that these corporations are being led by folks who do not put the safety of the people they're supposed to be serving at the forefront of their business decisions. It's all about profit. And to me, that was a surprise. And it's something that's definitely changed my perspective on, you know, big business.
Did you always want to be a lawyer? How'd you end up doing this type of law as opposed to, I don't know, going and...
I ended up doing this type of law because it was the most interesting to me. I mean, there's a lot of room to help people here, and a lot of the folks that we help really need our help. They don't have a voice, and most of the time they're going up against corporations who have massive amounts of resources to shut these folks up, and we're here to make sure that they can't shut them up, and that's something that was really attractive to me about this field of law.
Travis, thanks again. Really appreciate your time today. All right, folks. There you have it. You know, I think we're going to... So it has been an interesting a time in Vegas. I mean, this trip is always sort of fascinating to me. But there's also been... there's a lot more media people here earlier this week, some of whom, you know, I was able to grab, some who I'm not. But a lot more tomorrow. I think we're going to be talking to Tom Hartman. David Pakman may be here. And I think it's possible Ed Schultz is going to be here. He's walking around. And he has created a super PAC. He was actually a surrogate for Bernie Sanders at the debate in the spin room. So we may have him in a moment. I know there's a lot of people who are wondering as to how I've been doing at the gambling tables, and I am very proud to announce that I am up almost $87. I don't know. You know, you get the ones and you use those as tips at the table, so I'm not 100% sure, but I am up. I want to make that absolutely clear to Nikki, if she's listening. I'm not up as much as I had anticipated. I've been here since Monday night late, so by this point, according to my projections and my plans, frankly, I would be up closer to $7,500. That has yet to materialize, but I am not down. I am not down. And that is, I think, that is the key. So, unfortunately, Michael, back at the studio, things don't look so good for your bonus right now. And I want to also articulate that I'm in no way promising a bonus, even if I do end up with $7,500 or my original plan, which was to win $14,000 this week. We have our new hires are actually in studio training right now, and apparently I'm being told that I'm crazy by one of the new hires. So it's also, I should also tell you, Michael, that I am actually, the money I am using is, yes, is your pay. So I know you haven't assumed this risk, but that's what's happening. Let me get to some IMs, or I should really actually run through a couple of news stories just very briefly. That I think are relevant that we'll be talking about in the days and weeks to come. Apparently, President Obama is going to be announcing a halt of U.S. troop withdrawal in Afghanistan. The plan now is to keep thousands of troops in the country through the end of President Obama's term in 2017. He's going to announce this, I guess, today. A 14-year-old war, which is, it's just stunning that once we invaded this country, that we did not dedicate the forces at the time that was necessary to create some type of stability. And yet we stay there, we end up bombing hospitals, wedding parties. It's just unclear exactly what we hope to achieve. I mean, you know, what is going to be better in 2017 versus now? The current American force in Afghanistan is, I think, just a little bit below 10,000 troops. They were supposed to drop now, I guess, in early 2017 to about half that. Some of the troops will continue to train and advise Afghan forces. Others will carry on the search for al-Qaeda fighters. And militants from the Islamic State and other groups who have found a haven in Afghanistan. I mean, apparently the Taliban has just pulled back from their control of Kunduz. But the idea that they could take over a city in the north, I guess, has been of some concern. Perhaps we'll have a guest who is more knowledgeable about this in the coming weeks. The Washington Post reports today, apropos of our conversation with Cliff and Adam Green yesterday, a 2-year-old in South Carolina found a gun in the backseat of the car he was riding in, accidentally shot his grandmother. Apparently, these cases happen a lot more frequently than you think. Post reports that they found at least 43 instances this year of someone being shot by a toddler 3 or younger. Now, of course, these toddlers, what they do, ladies and gentlemen, is they seek out gun-free zones, which they know are soft targets. Children are born with an innate sense of where the soft targets are. 13 toddlers have inadvertently killed themselves with firearms in 2015. 18 more injured themselves, 10 injured other people, and 2 killed other people. I don't know. I hope, you know, if there's somebody out there, again, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. If somebody out there is really interested in this and wants to dig into this, to these stories and isolate what guns are being used here. You know, I will take that research that you're working on, and I will hook you up with either or both or more, you know, someone like an Adam Green. Maybe folks at Credo might be interested in something like this, Credo Action. Even the someone like Douglas Land at the Action Network. There are Cliff may know of folks as well. There's a lot of people out there who are really committed to this type of thing. And if I do so say so myself, that idea I think was a pretty good idea. Because I got to imagine, you know, say what you will, if you've got toddlers out there who are accidentally killing people, that seems to me to be an issue that I would imagine even a CEO of a gun manufacturer would have a problem with. Let's see what else we've got going here. I already mentioned the fact that we lost a sponsor today. So, Michael, is that what you're saying? You don't think that FanDuel is going to want? I'm not maligning FanDuel. I'm just saying I don't feel comfortable hyping a service that is, you know, is in the news because of potential investigations and lawsuits. So we are not in the fun half. We're going to do a freebie Thursday, Michael. Wait, was that Bill Burr clip? What is that? Okay, a parental warning. You can't send me a clip at 12:01. I play it on. What makes you think I have the ability to do that with this setup? Michael wants me to play a clip he sent me via IM. I can't do that. No, it doesn't matter if you send it again. I can't play it off my computer. Oh, boy, oh, boy. Michael. Yes, post it on the site. Bill Burr has a clip about by Bill Burr about, DraftKings. Okay, great. Yeah, post it on the site. All right, great. We have another guest coming to sit down. Continuing our coverage here at the Mass Torts Conference 2015. Like I say, I saw him in the spin room the other night after the debate, talking about Bernie Sanders' performance. I'd like to welcome to the show Ed Schultz, who apparently has started a super PAC, which I'd like to talk to you. But Ed, welcome to the program.
Sam, good to see you.
So let me just ask you about the debate since I have you here now.
Sure.
Right? And I know, and, you know, full disclosure, you were there as a surrogate for Bernie Sanders. And so I know you'll give your completely unvarnished opinion. But frankly, I mean, let's be honest, I think there's fairly broad consensus that Bernie Sanders did great. I mean, you know, people have said that other candidates did okay as well, but I think Bernie Sanders did great.
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that all of the candidates went into the debate with a strategy. And I think Bernie's strategy was to make sure that the people who were not exposed to him and didn't know who he was saw him on the largest platform he's ever been on, and he drove home the messages that he's been talking about on the campaign trail. I think it was a big introductory night for Bernie Sanders to a lot of Americans. So if you want to talk about winners and losers, as a lot of people are in our industry, big win for Bernie Sanders because a lot of people know more about him that really weren't familiar with him. His name recognition is right. One of his biggest attractors. I also think that the million people that have contributed to his campaign, they're believers even more. I thought he accomplished that he can stand on the stage and what he talks about is resonating with others. And I think that the big talking point that came out of the Sanders camp was the fact that they felt that Bernie had set the agenda.
Right.
That Wall Street has to be dealt with. The income inequality in this country is going to destroy the middle class if it continues. We've got to reverse these terrible trends that are taking place. The strategy, I believe, for Hillary Clinton was to get past two big things. Number one, flip-flops on two issues, Keystone and Trans-Pacific Partnership, and the other one was to digest and get rid of somehow on a national platform with a big audience the email controversy, which I think Bernie Sanders helped her do. The other candidates, I would make the case that Webb was just an insurgent disrupting the process and really didn't offer much other than his resume. Lincoln Chafee is just misplaced, although I think he's a good human being.
Right.
And I think that Martin O'Malley is well-intended, but his name recognition and his support is so far behind, he won't be a factor.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. One thing I noticed that resonated with me was that Hillary really attempted. I mean, I think you're right. Everybody went in there with their own agenda. And to a certain extent, she had to sort of stop the bleeding from the pundit class on some level, right? Because they were all freaking out that somehow her campaign was imploding. But it seemed to me that what she was also trying to do was to blur the distinctions between her positions and those of Bernie Sanders.
There's no doubt. That had to be one of her missions. And as I said, to get rid of those two big elephants in the room for the Clinton people are ecstatic. You know,
right.
They feel great about what they did, and I think that they feel like they got some mojo back in their campaign, which they've been lacking.
Right.
If you look at the polls over the last 4 months, Hillary has been sliding,
right,
although maintaining on the national level, but sliding in Iowa, sliding in New Hampshire, and in South Carolina. Now, she's strong in the African-American vote there, there's no doubt, but that goes to her name recognition and understanding who Bernie is. So the country tuned in the other night, Sam, to see two people, okay?
Yeah.
And that we're going to see them five more times.
And it's funny because they, in some ways they both succeeded. I mean,
wasn't
a
no
zero-sum a game there for them. And what do you think the next thing, if this was phase one, let's say, of Bernie's presentation to really a lot of people who really don't know him, what's phase two?
Well, I think Bernie needs to be a lot more clear, concise, and show conviction on foreign policy. And a major story that's developing today, the president announcing that we're going to keep combat troops in Afghanistan through 2017, and the number's 5,500. Well, the Democrats, the candidates, are going to have to decide quickly if that is what they would want to inherit, and is that the policy that they would continue. And I think Bernie needs to be a little bit more into the intricacies of what's happening in the Middle East with Syria. I do think what he is saying, though, is where the majority of Americans are, and that is, you know, we need some help from the Arab world. They have to take the lead in their neighborhood if we're going to fight ISIS. And putting troops on the ground is not the appetite of the American people right now. So that would be, to me, and continue to focus on the basics that, Bernie has pushed on throughout his campaign. But I think foreign policy is something he's going to have to be a little bit more direct on.
It also occurs to me, too, that that she, at one point, the distinction she was making is, I'm a progressive, but a progressive who gets things done, right? I mean, sort of implying that, and it resonated with me, I mean, frankly, because I took a ride last night with a guy who had told me that he had contributed to Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
But he wasn't sure. He didn't. All of the complaints about Hillary Clinton were ones that we were all too familiar with, you know, her relationship to corporations, to banks. He associates her with big money. But he wasn't sure about, even though he's contributed to Bernie Sanders, he wasn't sure. He said he'd probably vote for him, but he was concerned that Bernie Sanders wouldn't be able to govern because it would be too polarizing. and which was, you know, it was interesting because that was the distinction, right, that Hillary made, is that I've been able to reach across the aisle. Now, we both know that the Republicans, it really doesn't matter, right?
Like, no.
John Boehner could be the Democratic nominee.
They're going to obstruct any Democratic president and gum up the process as best they can.
But do you think that Bernie has to make that pitch to Democrats that, like, look, not only do you like my positions, but here is the pragmatic sales that I will actually be able to do these things because X, Y, and Z. I mean, you know, with the understanding that, yeah, the Republicans are going to be the Republicans.
Well, Bernie's main focus, I believe, in his campaign is to get the dirty money out of politics, to get the voice back to the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, to make sure that the little guy in America has a voice and that the middle class isn't destroyed. Okay, that's where he is. He believes that if he gets enough people in the process that we can overcome the obstruction that's taken place in Washington. And it's not going to be done in one election cycle. So he's a big vision guy. When Hillary Clinton said what she said about, but I get things done, in other words, I'll be a corporate Democrat when I have to be.
Right.
And it's almost a page out of Ted Kennedy. Ted Kennedy would take a lesser deal just to get the process moving because he knew generationally they would achieve things. And so, but the Republicans
are
not.
There's a danger in that. I mean, we wind up with stuff No Child Left Behind.
That's right.
I mean, there's a danger in that.
There is a danger in that, and that's why it's an ongoing process, and that's why it has to be a consistent focus and movement throughout. And I think that's where Bernie is right now. Hillary has gotten some momentum back in her campaign. They feel good about it. Bernie is going to have to be more aggressive in the next few debates. And I think he's also going to have to get to the point where he explains exactly his position on the middle class and his remedy for the middle class is different from Hillary Clinton's.
Right.
And that labor can count on him.
Right.
And he will be clear on the trade agreements, and he will be clear on minimum wage.
It was amazing the trade agreement didn't seem to come up, really.
Well, you know, Sam, the thing that bothers me, and I've spent a lot of time on the trade agreements because I think that is the real focal point of our economy.
You were the singular voice in the mass media talking about TPP for years.
Well, because I believe that it encompasses 40% of the globe. Gross domestic product, and it will gut American jobs. And it's a Wall Street deal, and it's being sold by the corporations, and it's been done with literally no debate and in the shadows of Congress, and that's wrong. So my frustration the other night was the only time that those issues of trade and Keystone came up was Hillary flipping on the positions.
Right.
And that was it. In fact, that was the first question. How can you be trusted if you flip on positions?
As opposed to actually talking the substance of the issues.
That's exactly right. And that was what I found to be very frustrating. It was almost like, okay, we covered that. Now let's move on.
Right.
And this is a huge deal. And Bernie's made it a huge deal.
It's amazing, too, because you probably have, like, I don't know, what a massive percentage of those 15 million people watching who have no idea what the words TPP stand for.
No question about it.
But it was just really more about, I'm going to ask you a question that's really more about your personality rather than the actual issue and the relevance. Yeah. I mean, that I think that's a real problem.
What I found interesting is that even days after the debate, people are trying to interpret what Bernie Sanders meant when he said to Hillary, nobody cares about your damn emails. Look, I don't think Bernie went into that debate trying to one-upman anybody. I don't think he went in there to take a shot at anybody. But I do think he went in there to make sure that the country stays focused on the major issues. There's a mechanism and a process in place that will vet out anything the former secretary did. It's called the FBI investigation. And if there's a problem there, they'll get to it. But this is the stage where the Democrats had in front of the American people to explain what their plan was to move the country forward and not to waste it on issues that don't matter to people sitting at home. People sitting at home watching, they don't care about Hillary's emails.
Right.
They want to know, okay, what's going to happen to my job? This election is going to be about jobs and wages.
All right. Along those lines, you have, gotten a little bit, political I mean, you're now sort of like moving into the process on some level as being, I guess, amongst the, some a consortium of people who have created a super PAC. What's it called? Give me the details.
Well, Sam, obviously I've had a career change. I've been in broadcasting for 40 years. I've had the luxury and the freedom and the opportunity and the pleasure of being able to do a lot of different things in my career. And this now takes me into a different stage. And when I went through a professional change in the middle of the summer, I sat back and thought about, okay, what does Ed Schultz do? What's the final? I mean, I could go home and go fishing forever, but, you know, that's not me. I'm in this fight for the middle class. I believe that we've got to address some issues. I think I've got a lot to contribute. And I do believe that I have found a void, and that is a super PAC, and we got to get in this business because this is the fishbowl we're swimming in if the progressive movement wants to move forward. Where's the void? The void is in the super PAC business, and so I have started a super PAC. It is a 527. It's nonprofit. I will not take a salary for the first 2 years, and it's incorporated in the District of Columbia, and it is Americans for a Strong Middle Class, ASMC. And we're going to focus on jobs, education, health care, trade agreements, and justice. These are the five issues we're going to go to. And we're going to get in local fights. We're going to use my voice on a local level because of my visibility and media experience. I believe I am perfectly positioned to help people out
right.
in fights across the country. For instance, one of the first things we're going to do is we're going to push back on right-to-work legislation in Ohio, which is crucial. The Republicans are putting a lot of effort into passing that in Ohio. They're doing a lot to suppress the vote. We've got to get out and make sure that those things don't happen. And so I want to lend my voice, my visibility, my media moxie, my experience. And this does take me into a new area of career where I am saying, hey, you know what? I need some money. You got to help out the progressive movement here. You got to
right.
support the middle class. And the one thing about this PAC, Sam, Americans for a Strong Middle Class, this will go beyond 2016. It transcends any candidate. It transcends any election cycle. And we are going to be faced with middle class issues for decades to come. And we're either going to reverse this or we're not. And when you think about the conservative movement in America and you think about super PACs, you think about Karl Rove
right.
and his constant visibility throughout all of the media and the Americans for Prosperity and how effective they have been on a local level in parochial fights and making a difference and turning people around. Well, what do we have on the left? This is where we have to go. We have to centralize the themes on the middle class and be competitive.
You know, as you're talking about this, I mean, I think, you know, one thing that strikes me as a bit of a model for you coming in and lending your voice, frankly, what your involvement in Wisconsin and
oh, yeah.
going to Madison. And I mean, that brought a lot of coverage, I think, there earlier that wouldn't have been there. I mean, obviously, you have your own. You have a show at that point, but even still, that raises obviously the level of local media paying
no
attention too, because if it's enough to bring you in there, it necessarily drives some
Sam,
media
I down. Knew what Governor Walker was up to from day one, and I knew that he would get some gains in Wisconsin, but I knew that his agenda nationally would be horribly rejected.
Right.
They had centralized the power in the Republican Party, and they were positioned to do the kind of radical things that they wanted to do in Wisconsin to attack workers. But I knew that it would not fly as a national platform. Walker was one of the first Republicans out of the race, an absolute zero. So, you know what? I'm on,
you
on your
admit,
broadcast
that
here.
Quicker.
That
happened quicker than anybody could have imagined.
It was
though, right?
It's maybe one of the biggest falls in all of politics.
It was unbelievable. It's
yeah.
like someone just pushed him off a cliff.
That's right. There's no question. And he became toxic. He was not a very deep candidate, didn't get to the issues. He was so agenda-driven against. He didn't know what he was for.
Yeah.
And anytime he got in trouble, he invoked Ronald Reagan. Well, it got elementary, it got old, and it burned out fast, and he's really an empty suit.
There, two things. I want to ask you about TPP in a moment in terms of if the dynamic in the Republican Party actually may help us in terms of scuttling this deal. But before we get there, my sense has been that through a lot of the things that were disappointing to progressives during the Obama administration, there became a little bit more of a savvy that, like, there's not going to be a specific shining knight in shining armor, that it's going to take long-term concerted organizing. I mean, I know, you had Adam Green on your program many times. The PCCC, to me, seems like an amazing organization that has been able to sort of been smart about developing relationships with candidates, showing them that they can win on a progressive message, leveraging that to push everyone else to the left. I mean, I think, you know, groups like that have a lot of, see that debate the other night, and they should be happy with what they've been able to achieve, because this is sort of stunning. Like, I don't think that we have ever seen a debate like that where the playing field, you know, regardless of whether or not there's certain insincerities or whether or not, you know, people are being as explicit about their positions, as the playing field, at least in terms of what they wanted to project, was decidedly more progressive than we've seen in, I think, 20, maybe 35, 40
McGovern
years.
Times.
Well, I mean, I think even Jesse Jackson in the mid-80s, we were hearing that message from a guy who had a legitimate chance to win the nomination. But that was definitely the last time we even heard it.
I wish Bernie Sanders had attacked the socialist label this way. People under 40 don't care. They care about their future.
If anything, it could be a net positive.
That's right. That's exactly right. And don't be put on the defensive by identity politics.
Right.
I think that's the first thing. To your point about messaging, you know, the PCCC is a vital organization. And if you get one victory, it's one more that you didn't have.
Right.
And if we can make a difference with the Super PAC, ASMC, and if we can get some victories, we can keep people excited and motivated that we can be a vehicle to answer back at some of these radical agendas that are out there on a state level and certainly a national level. It has to be answered. And so that is my mission. The first thing we want to do, Sam, we have to defeat this trade agreement. Now, I think it's great that Hillary Clinton has come out and said that she's not for it based on what she knows about it. That's wiggle room number one. I want to know if Hillary's picking up the phone and calling her friends in the Senate and all of these people in the House who have endorsed Hillary Clinton early on, if she's going to call them up and say, hey, you got to be with me to stop this deal.
Or at the very least, you would expect the media going to those people and
That's
saying,
right.
Hey, you just endorsed Hillary Clinton.
That's right.
Do you disagree with her on
the
TPP?
The corporate media is lazy on this issue. It's too detailed. There's too much minutia, and it's not sexy enough.
Right.
The Trans-Pacific Partnership, a trade deal that's going to affect American middle-class jobs, that's just not there. It's not in their wheelhouse.
Right.
But the political story here is we've got a reversal, folks, and there's a lot of people that have endorsed Hillary Clinton. Now, this narrative that CNN and some of the networks are playing right now, that Hillary Clinton is moving away from President Obama, no, she's not. She's moving towards her party.
Right.
The majority of Democrats in the House and in the Senate do not want this trade deal. And so Hillary isn't, you know, moving away from the president. She's moving towards her party. That's how I view it. Because this president, as you said, he's done some things and it's been a mixed bag, so to speak, of successes. This is the worst thing he's ever done.
Yeah.
This is the worst thing he's ever advocated for. He's been told by every single labor leader in this country, you cannot do this. And it's amazing to me that he is. I'll always cut President Obama slack because he inherited an economy that no one's ever seen since the Great Depression.
Right.
I'll cut him slack because he saved the automobile industry. I'll cut him slack because of the stimulus package and the, 60-some-odd months of private sector job growth with no help. And I'll cut him some slack because he's the most obstructed president in the history of the country. But a lot of that good can be wiped out by making a wrong-headed decision on this trade agreement. There might not have to be another trade agreement after this one.
But this is, I mean, at this point, right, it's a done deal as far as Obama's concerned. It seems to me that the real state of play happens in the Senate.
Yeah.
And the House Democrats, for the most part, are against this deal. Here's
House Democrats know they're not going to win the majority. So House Democrats are doing everything they can to help the Senate get the power back to the Democrats. That's where their focus is really now.
Well, so let me ask you this. I mean, do you think that between the disarray the Republicans are in terms of the Speaker of the House, like, I mean,
yeah.
I don't know who it's going to be. I mean, it could be, don't know, they bring you in. At this point, like, who knows, right? And I wonder if Donald Trump, who has already, prior to being a candidate, was putting out ads against the TPP, I wonder if he says to Marco Rubio in the next debate,
has to be,
where are you going to be on TPP, right? Because this is one of the primary ways that he can attack him.
Sam, I spoke to a union leader the other day who told me that if you took the poll right now, a third of their members would vote for Trump. He has tapped into the white, working, middle-class, blue-collar workers in this country. And this is a problem. Now, it's as much a problem for the Democrats as it is a problem for the Republicans. Trump knows how injurious this is going to be to the economy. It's a fool's errand. And I wish the president would back off. And you know who's going to save us from all of this? Activists that are listening.
Right.
Activists that want to get involved. The United States Congress can save us from this. That's the firewall right now. There's about a 90-day, examination period of this before the Congress is going to move on it, and then there's going to be a vote. And Mitch McConnell is saying some interesting things right now. There's going to be a serious vetting process on all of this. He knows that there's some rats in the corner.
Right.
And they don't want to be on the wrong side of this because this is irreversible.
All right, so Ed, so where can people get more information on Americans for a Strong Middle Class?
Well, there's a process to all of this, Sam. You have to be legally put together. You have to do the foundational groundwork of networking out and talking about what you're going to do. And then you have to put your website together. And then you have to do your networking in the social world. So to say, we're not quite in the infancy stages, but we are not fully up and ready to say to people, hey, start sending your checks.
Okay.
Okay. There has to be a process to this. Strong messaging first. Get people aware of what we're doing. Get totally set up. And then start going after it.
I mean, it was announced literally
this morning.
This morning. Okay. Yeah so I guess.
The first article came out this morning.
Well, you've had, was it this morning, East Coast or West Coast?
Who knows? I don't know. The moon went over the last hill in Nevada, I don't know.
Ed Schultz, thanks so much for your time today.
Sam,
really
good to visit with you. Yeah, and great to be with you on Ring of Fire and also in your productions. You guys do great work. And the website is absolutely fantastic. And a lot of people are going to it. It's growing by leaps and bounds. There's a real void out there, and you guys are filling it, and I'm glad to be a part of it. Good to visit with you.
Yes, thanks so much. All right, folks. We have really getting a bonus show today, folks. This will all come out of Michael's pay, so he will. But I will answer just a couple more IMs here, and then we will sign off. We've got a lot. Lucifer, don't know where Matt's boss head was last night, who thought Sanders was one of the losers. Matt's new boss is Carl Digler's? I have no idea what that means. Lawyer Matthew, pump up the volume, all right? Doe Link, Chris did a big piece on FanDuel last week. Yeah, well, I mean, I... has the volume been low? Well, that's a surprise to me. Andre, did you catch the HuffPost article about Carson suspending campaign for book tour? Is this guy serious about running for president? It is a book tour. And, I had just picked that up. I couldn't make out whether or not this was a function of him. Look, folks, the guy is, I imagine there's a certain amount of disarray in his campaign. I imagine there's also a certain amount of surprise in his campaign, because even they didn't realize that the Republican Party was that messed up. So I don't know. I think he's serious about running for president, but he spent all this time learning about the Knesset and parliamentary system in Israel. So maybe he is. A Square. Sam, we enjoy your Mass Tort Conference coverage every year. Also, good tweets on the debate. You like the one about the urinals. The faux populism notwithstanding, I think Hillary Rodham Clinton had a very strong performance. And frankly, I love the statement about the gun owner liability immunity. Sorry, Bernie. And being sick and tired of the attacks on Planned Parenthood. Great to see the Overton window move to the left. And Bernie mentioned political revolution many times. Indeed. AJS. It's like having Medicare. Related to your discussion of buildings and liability, I will say as a designer and architect in New York, there's a complete regulatory capture. I'm writing new code. The trades are in the room with the code writers. The code revisions, for the most part, will be things unnecessarily requiring seismic compliance in row houses, which means a ton more steel for the steel trades, or reducing the required distance for outlets, increasing profits for electrical trades. Very rarely will code revisions have anything to do with improving safety or reducing fraud for consumers. Well, you know, that is the... that is what I find stunning about the claim from libertarians that somehow if you had smaller government, there'd be less corporate power. The fact is that their power does not exist in a vacuum. It is always a dynamic. It is always a relationship. And the reality is, because a municipal elected official can be bought for so much less money, the power dynamic is even worse. Is there a single mayor in this country? Is there a single city council person in this country whose votes could not be bought with a fraction of what we see being spent in the presidential campaign? It's like having Medicare and not allowing it to negotiate drug prices, kind of similar. Hey, Sam, you can't be denying the rights of law-abiding citizens, even if they are 2 years old, from second amendmenting their relatives. It's not about smaller or bigger government. It's who the government is working for. Well, I understand, but this is also the idea being that when I say smaller government in this context, I'm talking about more local control. For some reason, libertarians are under the delusion that somehow local control is less corruptible. Benja, Matt is gone one day and nothing works, no streaming anywhere. Well, I think we are streaming. Chem Champion. Hey, Sam, I have a favor to ask. My contracts law professor seems to be like a nice guy, but he's a big fan of arbitration. He states definitively that criticism of arbitration, such as the repeat a player effect, are unfounded. He says that all empirical studies show that little guys do better in arbitration versus jury trials, including win more often, receive more in damages, and get quicker justice, and have a lower bar to participate, saying most lawyers won't take a case unless 100K is being sought. Could you ask the lawyers of the Tort Conference if there's any studies that would refute what he's saying? I'd really appreciate it. Well, even if there aren't, the issue is not that arbitration in and of itself is bad. It is that arbitration that is forced by a contract on a weaker party is bad. I don't think you could find an attorney here who would say, oh, yeah, no. No one should ever go to arbitration. They all say that people should have the option of going to arbitration. Jay-Z, in response to your guest comment on the general assumption of costs in England pushing defendants towards settlement, as a litigator in England, I would say that we're actually moving away from the traditional loser-pays system of legal costs towards an ugly hybrid of the American champerty system, lawyer's share in the claimant's damages. Okay. The DX full. Hi, Sam. Volume's pretty low, including the bumper music. Could you or Mike please pot it up? Also, will you and Pap tomorrow discuss the new Bobby Kennedy Jr. biography that's coming out? Unlikely, based on that quote you just sent me. Sam, when you say you're not down after you're saying you plan to be up 7,500, does not down mean you haven't lost 7,500, merely something less than 7,500? No, I mean, it means that my projection was that I would have made 7,500 by now. Instead, I am only making, I've only made 100. That's basically where I'm at with that. So, sadly. That's what I mean by that. I will check the sound levels. Jay Shiva, grandma was shot with a 357, apparently. 1020. Hey, Sam, I have a quick question. Yesterday, I saw you for the first time on at the MSNBC. We don't have TV. You'll understand as your kids grow how much grief you'll save if you don't have a TV. You know, my kids are pretty good about that, actually. But my partner had the live stream on. I yelled, hell, that's Sam. But I was surprised by the tame nature of your comments. I noticed you were holding off a smile at the notion of the always progressive Hillary, but your comments were not nearly as sharp as they were on the radio that day. Did you purposely tame your comments? Is that a request to be? No. No, I didn't. I didn't. You know, to be honest with you, I almost missed that. I literally made that hit by 30 seconds. I had run in there, and I couldn't tell what was going on. So it was really more of just sort of the situation. I'm usually in studio, and I think there I get a lot more animated and into it. I didn't want to cut her off, and I had assumed that he would come back to me, but he didn't. It was really more of the production circumstance. Love your show. Oh, thank you. Monica, why does Hillary's email server matter? Why doesn't Hillary's email server matter? I think it does. I don't know what is supposed to be so nefarious. I mean, we saw this with Colin Powell. I think the idea that, I think it was a stupid thing on a political level, but I just don't think that there is any sort of nefarious scandal thing there. I guess if there is, the FBI will find it. Please ask Ed how he felt Bernie handled the marijuana question. Is Ed convinced by what Bernie says? Says Jimmy Reefer Cake. Sorry, Jimmy, I just saw that. Really? Just got high twice? I'm surprised. Jay Tingle, that's the difference between you and Ed Schultz. He has media moxie. You better get off the dime. All right. The missing link, my tweet yesterday recommending liability insurance on every firearm piece of ammo. Firearm was answered by a Second Amendment troll sporting a rainbow flag with crossed bars, a la Confederate flag for ABI. So I engaged in perhaps six exchanges till I was confronted by a vortex. We live in an alternative universe, which to him the word militia means all citizens and well-regulated means working correctly. I declined to respond to after the troll set those conditions. I understand. Censor sweep. Jesse Ventura was on the nightly show Tuesday night, and I think he said he might run on the Libertarian ticket. Sandinista, Sam, really loved the Tort Conference shows. Great stuff. The article on cafe.com that someone complained about was satire. Yakative, I think O'Malley is slimy too. I saw him at the Dem convention. I think he vetoed every parole board recommendation he ever got. Have your peeps check it out. Pinky, streaming is great. The mechanism. Libertarians are willfully ignorant of what almost always happens when there's a power vacuum. This isn't an insult, but they really do look at the world through the eyes of a 10-year-old boy. B-Hob. Seatbelts have saved 200,000 lives since 1975, yet we can't design toddler-proof guns? We can, but there's just no incentive for it. Jermo. Sound is good during the entire show. Cat. Holy crap. Ed Schultz on a Majority Report. How the chimes change. I recall turning off my AM radio during an irrational rant, Ed rant to Re-Sam back in the day. Those were years ago, ladies and gentlemen. Also, did he know he was on the four-time winning majority report? I never tell anybody what I'm doing. That way I can get them to comply. It's always better to apologize than to ask permission. Great leap forward. The volume is great. You need an announcement to tell those with hearing aids to turn them up. Sound is great. You know, sometimes I think what happens is we could be streaming in a mono or on one channel. I'm not sure. I'm guessing here. And so it's possible that if people are listening on speakers and they're only getting one channel, that could be the problem. The final IM of the day, ladies and gentlemen, Militant Apathy, once again, another crappy prosecutor covering for a crappy cop. It isn't going to stop until we do something about the prosecutors. All right, folks, I'll be back live again tomorrow at, I guess, 12 noon Eastern, 9 a.m. here on the, I don't know, am I on the West Coast? Pacific time. All right, folks, see you tomorrow. See you tomorrow. To get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there.